This is the Looking Glass podcast, and I'm here with Paul Neurath. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. And you were the founder of the company, or the sole founder, or one of the founders?
I was the founder, and for most of the years, essentially ran product development. I was formerly the CEO for a bunch of years as well.
And so I would like to start a bit with what you were doing before that and how you got into it. You used to work for Origin, correct?
I
made a game for that.
I got in the game industry in the mid '80s, just after the Apple II started to become very popular. And I just on a whim, I bought an Apple II. I'm not even sure why. It just seemed cool to have a personal computer. At college, we had a mainframe, time sharing mainframe, and so this was an era where, you know, before the Apple II, where, you know, computers were something that you had to go to a university or, you know, corporation to get access to. So the thought of having one's own computer seemed pretty compelling. And when I bought it at a computer store in Cambridge, they had a rack of software. Back then it was in plastic baggies. It wasn't even shrink wrapped. And picked up a game called Ultima and Wizardry.
The first one? Like Ultima 1?
It was the first one. And Wizardry and a couple other games and Zork, had a lot of fun with them, and decided just to give it a try of doing a game. I had a full-time job, but, you know, kind of nights and weekends started working on a game, got that game. Took some time because it was part-time, but I got that game published to Surtek, who was the publisher of Wizardry. And it did pretty well, and it really, for me, was, you could make a living on this. You could actually, you know, do this full time. So switched to doing that full time, and pretty quickly started to work closely with Origin, who was one of the early game publishers and developers in the 80s and in the 90s. And they were based, for a number of years, they were based in New England, in Massachusetts and in New Hampshire. So they were local to me. And I just drove up to their offices in Andover at the time, and just introduced myself to Richard Garriott and the other guys there.
He was here? Richard Garriott?
Yeah,
was
the whole team was here.
Really? Okay.
It was a small, you know, this was an era where the game publishers tended to be pretty small. This was before EA came on the scene and the public, you know, the companies that went public and all of that. So Origin had 10, 12 people, something like that. They were actually here because Richard and Robert, two brothers, founded the Origin, and the only one in the extended family who had a regular paying job was Robert's wife, who worked at AT&T as an executive, and so they felt, there's a steady income at least, you know, as we try this out. So a lot of us were kind of doing this on a more experimental basis. It wasn't, you know, clear that there was a real long-term opportunity at this point in the 80s. So I started working with them. I was never actually an employee, but I was an independent author, and I did. I helped them out on some of the games. I worked on Ultima 3 and Ultima 4, doing some design work. I worked on a game called Ogre, which was a strategy game, Steve Jackson's strategy game that was brought over, and some other titles, Auto Duel, which was an early classic car combat game. But I was doing my own game, Space Rogue. And Space Rogue was my first attempt to try to do sort of a cross-genre game where I was blending some very early 3D graphics and space flight simulation with role-playing.
What year was this?
That came out in, I have to remember, 88, 89?
So Space Rogue was late 80s by that point.
I started working in Origin probably 86, 87. Hmm. And so it was kind of, you know, I was doing bits and pieces of different projects. So Space Rogue was kind of a half-time effort to get that done. And it was in the era where a lot of games still were being developed by a single person. So I did it on my own, and it was a stretch of skills because I'm not an artist. I had an engineering background, but I don't have, you know, an art background. But, you know, I did all the art and the design and, you know, basically put it on a floppy disk and handed it to Origin when it was done to duplicate and
market. Did it fit
market.
On one at the time?
You know, I think it took two.
Two, okay.
I think it took
big,
two.
It was big.
It was a big game for its time. And actually, you know, it did pretty well. And I learned a lot. It was really my first substantive kind of commercial game that I'd done, besides working with the Origin folks and the other games that they were doing. But I learned a lot in those three and a half years. It was a great team. You know, Richard and Chuck Boucher and Chris Roberts had joined. Chris Roberts had started up there, and actually he played a bunch of Space Rogue, and that was, you know, kind of inspiration for Wing Commander.
Yeah, because it was a Space Rogue is a space flight simulation that's kind of narratively focused in some
that's
ways, right? But
that,
it's
right.
prefigures Wing Commander.
Yeah, Chris and I had a lot of, you know, kind of early game discussions about how you would take the space genre and move it forward. But there was some real talent at Origin. I mean, it was just sort of a nice confluence of talent and doing some real pioneering work in the industry. So it was great to be part of that. Origin made the decision to move to Texas because Richard and Robert grew up in Texas and wanted to move back there. So it took about a year for them to move people out there. They did it in chunks. But as they were moving out there, it was clear that there wouldn't be a team left in, they were in New Hampshire at the time, they'd all be gone within a year or so. And so the opportunity to work with a team, and I didn't want to move to Texas. So really it was, for me, it was, what am I going to do? And that was the impetus to start Blue Sky Productions, which was started in very early 1990. And it was my first, entrepreneurial chance to start a studio and bring a team, hire a team and build a team and work on projects as an independent, studio. So that started as Blue Sky Productions. And our first two titles out of the gate, Ultima Underworld, we started working on. It was actually called Underworld. It wasn't an Ultima.
It wasn't the Ultima license originally.
No, we started it. And I was fortunate to, through a mutual friend, got me in touch with Doug Church, who was at MIT at the time. Yeah, he was a junior, I think. And he was really into gaming. And so I talked with Doug, and he was very interested in working on, Underworld. So brought him aboard, even though he hadn't graduated yet. There was a couple other folks that I knew had worked with through Origin, who likewise didn't want to move to Austin. So we brought a couple of ex-Origin people aboard, Doug, an artist who I had worked with before, we had basically five people, including myself, initially. So it was a small team, and we started working on Ultima. And then soon after, we got EA approached us about doing one of the early Maddens, Madden 93. Madden 92, I can't remember now. It was either Madden 92 or Madden 93, I can't even remember now. It would have come out in 91, so it must have been Madden 92. Anyway, so we started, those were our first two projects, which were very different kinds of games. One being a Sega Genesis console NFL football game, and the other being a PC role-playing game.
So was there, how far back does the Madden franchise go before that? So were they just asking you to do one of them? Or?
Yeah, just one of them. I had worked with EA. I'd done some work on Chuck Yeager's Flight Trainer, which was a big hit for them in the 85, 86, 87 period. I'd done some development work on that. So I knew a bunch of the EA folks. And
is this before EA owned Origin?
Yes. Well, by the time Blue Sky, I'm trying to think of the timing on this. I believe this was still, I don't recall the, yes, this would have been before they owned Origin. So this is just separate from Origin.
Okay.
So we were developing Underworld on our own. This was before we had started discussions with Origin about the game. And then I had approached, had discussions with EA. I guess they had the Madden under development with a team, and that team wasn't working out. And so they were scrambling to find a team to pick it up. And, Madden is under, it has to be released before the start of every football season. So it's under a very tight date. And as I recall, we were 5 months before it had to complete. And they gave us the source code from the previous year's version, and they said, you've got 5 months to get it done. So it was an introduction to the EA way of sometimes doing, which is, really just having to, push hard on this. We actually found a couple of contract developers to work on that project. We didn't, in terms of the engineering, so we sort of did it part out of house and part in house.
I'm really interested in the, that's really fascinating to me, because this is the first I've heard about the Madden being the kind of parallel thing. With Underworld.
Blue Sky and Looking Glass were not known for generally for sports games that we did.
You did do a few though, right?
We did several golf games as well, but the football, you know, in that in our first year and a half of Blue Sky, those are the two games we released: Ultimate Underworld and Madden. Yeah, Madden was one of the most successful games I've ever worked on. It was the first game in EA's history to break 1 million units in sales, and it helped them go public. And I remember going to an analyst meeting where the CFO stood up and showed Madden on a big screen and said, you know, this is one of the games that's going to help us do our IPO. So it was a wild ride to be part of that project. And a lot of that is just the franchise, and we didn't originate it, but we made some nice improvements to it, and it was quite a successful title. So we were kind of an interesting place because we had these two very different kinds of games we worked on. But, you know, Ultima was a game that we had originated, you know, it was our concept, and we for the most part, owned that IP. Madden was a work for hire. And so that really bifurcated how we looked at it, because we couldn't control where Madden went. And actually, EA decided to bring that in-house because they saw how much money it was making, and the royalties they were paying us were quite substantial. And it was really the royalties of Madden more than anything else at that point that allowed us to grow the business. Mm-hmm. But EA and their, you know, from their business point said, you know, this is too expensive to do it this way. You know, Madden's becoming such a huge franchise. We have to bring it in-house and really control it and, you know, kind of not let these royalties go out. Wow. So much go out of the house. So they ultimately moved it entirely in-house. But that really, that opportunity, that door, for the most part, closed for us. But it was interesting because it set some of the tone. The other project, which, you know, really Looking Glass kind of game that set the tone for what, you know, what became Looking Glass was Ultima. It started as Ultima. We did a demo. We showed it in the spring of 1990 around it to some of the publishers and a couple of the industry shows at the time. And it was difficult to find a publisher for it. You know, there was it wasn't something that the publisher saw and said, yes, that's you know, that's going to be a successful game. It was very different from games that had been done before.
Nobody had done the scrolling 3D at that time, right? Except
yeah,
for Wolfenstein. It was sort of around the same time. Right?
We came out, this was before Wolfenstein had come out. So when we were showing the demo, it was the first time these publishers had seen texture mapping and moving through a 3D environment with texture mapping. And I'm pretty sure we were the first folks in the games industry to do texture mapping. I played around with texture mapping while I was at Origin in the late 80s on an Apple 2GS. The frame rate was you know, a couple of seconds per frame, so it just wasn't possible to do real-time texture mapping of an environment on a 2GS, or at least I wasn't smart enough
and
to figure out.
Space Rogue, even though it was 3D, didn't have any texture mapping. So.
No, it just did solid fills of the surfaces. I mean, I did some texture pattern-y sort of stuff, but it wasn't true texture mapping. So I had done 3D, and I had some background in 3D, but I didn't have the technical skills to really push it to the next level. And that's, you know, some of the folks who brought aboard, like Doug, James Fleming, and others who worked on that. Chris Green, who was another guy I had worked with, actually did the original texture mapping algorithm that we used in that early demo for Underworld. And then later, James in particular, a couple other guys made a variety of optimizations and made it more general. But this is the first time that people had seen that approach. And what was interesting is that when we showed it to industry development folks at the time, they pretty much got it. And they said, you know, this is a whole new kind of approach to stuff. And there was a lot of interest. Publishers, they couldn't match it up to, you know, what had been successful on the marketplace in the last year, which is different. And that's always been a challenge, I think, in any media industry when they see something that doesn't match what's currently, you know, successful. So it was actually pretty difficult to find a publisher. We circled back with Origin because of my relationship there, and they agreed to do it. they weren't, you know, head over heels about it, but they said, yeah, this is interesting. I think they viewed it as an experiment. Let's try this out. I'll give the credit to Richard. I mean, Richard's always been, a genuine visionary. And so he, more than anyone there, said, you know, this is an interesting new direction if we take the Ultimas there. But I want to put the Ultima brand on it, you know, and I'd be interested in seeing if we, you know, did a first-person 3D version of Ultima. So he thought that would be an interesting experiment to see whether that would be successful or not. So later that year, we closed a publishing deal with Origin, put the Ultima in front of the Underworld, and went forward with Origin on it.
Doesn't that also kind of harken back to the earlier Ultimas 2, which had those kind of like 3D dungeons that were not really 3D?
It does, and that was partly, you know, Richard had done a very early work in the sort of wizardry style. I think Wizardry, Dungeon Hack, some of those games were the first to do the sort of the step at one time, 2.5D, if you will. So the Ultima, earlier Ultimas had that in it. And so I think Richard saw this as, oh, this is the next evolution of that approach. So we worked with Origin, and we were fortunate near the towards the end of the project, we got assigned a new producer who was relatively... well, he wasn't new to Origin, but he was new to the project, Warren Spector. And, you know, he saw the potential for the project and was a real champion, because it was kind of a, you know, it was treated as an experimental project and kind of a side project for from Origin's standpoint as a publisher for most of its development. And it took 16 months, 15 months, something like that, from start to finish for the project.
So Warren was the producer on the Origin side? I think.
Yes, he was an Origin producer who actually joined as Space Rogue was wrapping up in 88, did some writing on the last month of the project.
For Space Rogue.
So I got to know Warren from there, because he was kind of a writing background guy, new to the game interactive industry at that time. So we reconnected up in the last months of the project. He became our producer on the project, which gave it, you know, which really helped, because it was kind of, you know, kind of not going anywhere, you know, much at Origin. And it was brought as kind of a real project and got production and got started to get marketing. But even, you know, the day it was launched, Origin, I think, saw it was a question mark. And again, I think it's just like any publisher at that time, it was very different. There was no benchmark to look at it with other products.
It seems like anybody who was familiar with video games, and I understand if you're a marketer, you're not thinking like this necessarily, but from the perspective of what had been done with technology, how exciting that project was rather obvious. It's 3D, but it moves, and yeah, you know what yeah. I mean? And I've never seen
We
this.
Didn't really get that reaction from the folks at Origin, but by and large, particularly on the marketing and business side of things. I don't think they saw it that way. Partly, Wing Commander had been, I can't recall whether it had been released. I think it might have been recently released or was released around that time. And Origin was very excited about Wing Commander. It would justify, you know, for good reason. It was a superb game, and it was pioneering in a lot of ways in its own right. Visually, the cinematic approach that was taken there was visually something that the Origin marketing folks really got behind and thought this is a breakthrough, this sort of cinematic approach to storytelling. We weren't doing that in Ultima Underworld. You know, we were doing a real-time immersive environment. It didn't visually stack up in terms of screenshots or sort of Hollywood storytelling comparison. So by that benchmark, we weren't there. Mm-hmm. There was a question. Again, the fair way to say it is it wasn't that they didn't. I think they appreciated that we were doing some very innovative stuff and some pioneering. The question mark was, would it be commercially received? Which is a fair question in the games industry, you know, to... Being innovative doesn't, by any stretch, you know, assure any level of success. So we had our own question marks. Is this really going to work? Do people want this kind of... It was, from my perspective, working on Space Rogue, it was another evolution in the step of this hybrid gameplay. Yes, it had the 3D, and that was its own element. But the gameplay, why people would stay with it for the longer haul and why it would ultimately be a success, came down to whether the hybrid gameplay of this sort of simulation aspects of gameplay, this real-time immersive, with the role-playing, you know, sort of traditional role-playing elements woven together. would that work? People hadn't really done that before. That it was as much as, if not more than, the texture mapping, the experiment. And, you know, you could have a game that looks great or is a different kind of innovation. LucasArts had done a procedural fractal generated game a couple of years earlier, which was very cool use of fractals in the industry, and it flopped. You know, so it doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, it's going to be successful. So there were a lot of question marks. It was launched. It was kind of a soft launch, and it didn't do great right out of the gate. It didn't do huge numbers, partly because it didn't get a lot of marketing. But it word of mouth. It's just kept on selling and selling and selling. Ended up doing over 500,000 units, which is huge for that time.
That's how I heard about it.
Yeah,
I remember a friend of mine. He heard from a friend of his.
It actually outsold all of the previous Ultimas, any of the previous Ultima,
really?
3, 4, 5, all
wow.
of those. And but it took a while. It took, you know, a couple of years to get there. It was just one of these games. There's been other games like that. The Age of Empires is an example mm-hmm. of that. It just kept on, you know, selling over the long haul and through word of mouth.
For a long time, there was nothing like it.
Yes.
For the first few years.
There was a lot of innovation, and I think, you know, we had we were well ahead of where other folks in the industry, because other people hadn't. I mean, not even the technology was all that difficult. We came to the MIT library when I was, you know, figuring out the algorithms originally, to see what, you know, Evans and Sutherland and some of these guys had done in the you know, the late 70s and early 80s. They had done most of the work on early texture mapping, and we didn't do much different. I mean, we basically changed the code to take advantage of what, you know, the processors of the day would do. But at a high level, we weren't doing anything new from the technology standpoint. We just, that technology hadn't been applied in the personal, you know, in the personal computers.
So you went to the MIT library?
Yeah, and I can't remember the name. I don't even know if it's still around, but the one that's circular.
Okay. I'm trying to remember which. I mean, I'm trying to remember what all the different names are. But
this would have been in like 86 or 87, so it's a lot of years ago.
Is that what you were thinking? You were thinking, I bet they've figured this out, so you just went to check it out?
Well, I had gotten, you know, ACM and SIGGRAPH, you know, publications, and I had seen some of the stuff being talked about on the workstations of the time, graphic workstations. So this was stuff all being done on graphic workstations and not in PCs, and had seen some stuff on texture mapping. So, you know, I went to get, you know, some of the source articles that had been written about, you know, what these guys had been doing. And, you know, the algorithms aren't all that sophisticated by modern standards. They just hadn't been applied, and I think people maybe just didn't think that a personal computer had the horsepower to do it. It was a realm of graphic workstations only. And it barely worked. I mean, one of the challenges of the game for Ultima Underworld was that we had to do all the rendering in software. There was no hardware rendering at that time. It wouldn't be for some years. And it, you know, the PC of that time, the IBM PC of that, barely had the horsepower to do it. And, you know, on a good day, we were getting, you know, in the low teens of frame rate. And we couldn't even do a full screen. I remember this was something.
It's a little window, right?
It's just about half of the screen of a VGA screen was, if we went full screen, it was too slow. Couldn't you know, get into the, you know, low single digits. And that was actually one of the concerns from Origin standpoint, because Wing Commander was a cinematic full screen, and we had this little window. And, you know, it compromised the visual impact. If you play a modern, you know, shooter today, you do it in full screen, you do it at high resolution, and you do it in a big monitor. So, you know, you can imagine something that's, you know, 150 by, you know, 100 pixel kind of size is a pretty tiny 3D window viewport. And it doesn't give you the, you know, you want to match the person's sort of field of vision, because your goal is to be immersive. You're in that environment. And Ultima Underworld required a bit of a, you know, visual suspension of disbelief in that regard. So there were some real compromises, because the hardware was barely capable of doing it. The frame rate was pretty pokey for the time. You know, we decided to do true 3D texture mapping. We did some hacks, but essentially was 3D. You could look up and down. We texture mapped, you know, the different surfaces. And and we created environments. The dungeon environment was, you know, was blocky, but it was 3D. You could go around corners, up and down chasms, underground streams, stuff like that. And but it came, you know, we were really pushing the edge. And, you know, was that the best business decision? I don't know. You know, we wanted to push it. We wanted to see how far we could go with it. We learned a lot from it. And we ended up ahead of other folks in the industry, I think, because of that. So that was an advantage. Unfortunately, we didn't take full advantage of that. And partly those were business reasons. When Ultima Underworld, the first ones, started to show signs of being a robust seller, Origin came back and said, let's do a sequel. But I think they were still in the question mark stage. So their sort of business take on is, maybe this is kind of a fad. Let's do a quick sequel. So if you can deliver a title in 9 months, a sequel, no more than 9 months, we'll do the sequel. But you have to agree to that. And they really pushed us very hard. And I don't even remember if it was even 9 months. It was pretty quick after that we pushed out Ultima Underworld 2. And I think in hindsight, I mean, we agreed to it and all, but I think in hindsight, we took what was an edge in all the learning, and then we kind of rushed the next one. And it's not, I mean, Ultima Underworld 2 did some very nice things, particularly on some of the ways we, you know, created the dungeons and the storytelling. But because it was rushed and because we were kind of just trying to push it out there, we weren't able to grow our lead and really leverage the full learning that we did. And Ultima Underworld 2 ended up selling less than half as well as Ultima Underworld, which is a real telling thing. And so I think, you know, had we do it over again, we would have said, no, we want to, you know, spend a full year and a half or, you know, or instead of the, you know, 9 months, and really try to, you know, push it further and do sort of full justice to this, you know, franchise in the making. But at the time we signed this on, and again, this is part of the dynamic of being a small developer. You know, we finished Ultima Underworld. We funded most of it ourselves. You know, Origin only funded about 10% of the development. And so we were financially very strapped the day after it was published, and we needed to find another project and get it signed it up soon. So there was a real, you know, we got a team now. We had grown to about a dozen people at that time. It felt pretty big to us. And, you know, we needed to, you know, find, you know, feed these folks and move on to the next project. So that was the quickest opportunity for us to do that. And royalties from these projects typically take months before you start seeing royalties come in. And so, at any rate, we moved right on to Ultima Underworld 2. But I think we lost some opportunity to build the Ultima Underworld franchise. And, of course, nothing came out after that. I mean, that was... Ultima Underworld 2 came out in 93, if I recall.
Possibly, yeah.
I think it came out in 93, and there's not been an Underworld since.
There's been a lot of spiritual successors,
yes,
to Underworld for various people who have been obsessed with the games, yes. And I know that the team that made that game, Arx Fatalis,
yes,
were just like, they were nuts about
it.
We did
some work on Arx Fatalis. We were involved in kind of like Floodgate. We got involved in that project.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yes, no, but I think that because of the second one, the sales were okay, but not great. For Origin, it almost, I think, confirmed, oh, this is a fad. You know, this was something that had its, you know, day in the sun. Doom came out around. Doom, and then Quake came out, and Doom, and then Quake. Really just showed a much bigger sales potential than we had done, you know, broke over 1 million units and went from there. And so I think some of the attention, you know, in terms of first person, a lot of the attention started to shift to shooters. It became, you know, almost synonymous from a publisher's perspective. If it's a first person, it's a shooter. Why would you do a role-playing game? You're just slowing things down, mucking stuff up, you know. In the game industry, often there can be, you know, a particular look or game mechanic gets associated with a genre. And in my mind, those things don't have any necessary relation other than historical happen to be. But from a commercial perspective and a marketing perspective, it's easier to think about marketing a shooter if you're a publisher, because you see the success of a game like Doom and then Quake. And that's continued up to this day. So there are not many modern examples of hybrid, you know, role-playing first-person games that have been blockbusters. There's plenty of examples of first-person shooters that have been blockbusters. Chicken egg question, it may be, is that just because the, you know, market and publishers have kind of gotten behind that, built a sort of repertoire of those titles, put a lot of effort in those, a lot of refinements. I mean, the modern shooters of today look, you know, visually stunning and are very refined. The best ones are extremely refined games. You haven't seen a tenth of that level of kind of push behind, say, you know, role-playing first-person games. So would a role-playing first-person game, you know, stand toe-to-toe with one of those games? Maybe it would, but I don't know if we'll ever know that.
Well, what's really interesting to me about when you mention the role-playing plus the simulation aspect of it, one of the themes that's come up in the podcast talking to other people over and over again is exactly that, is simulation as a kind of a design aesthetic. And it's interesting to me, sort of some of the genealogy of Looking Glass. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not coming from Origin exactly, but Origin sort of being involved in the beginning. And I know that company had the tagline for that company was, "We create worlds," mm-hmm. right? So there was, and I know that even in the earlier Ultima games, there was a kind of, and I know in the later stuff, like Ultima 7 was famous for just, I mean, it was a story, but it was also sort of first, before that, it was just kind of like a simulated world. And there was people who would have schedules. And I know that in the case of Looking Glass, it seems to me like there was a lot of that mentality still kind of built into the kind of games that you wanted to make.
Yeah, well, you know, the three and a half years I spent, you know, working closely with Origin guys, you know, we all influenced each other. So, you know, I worked pretty closely with Richard on a couple of his games, and I was working on Space Rogue, worked with Chris Roberts. So we all had our own take, but yes, I mean, Origin was very much into this sort of virtual worlds. You create your world, that sense, more from a role-playing standpoint. Chris brought on the cinematic plus the 3D of space combat and blending those elements and those hybrid elements. I kind of started the whole hybrid thing with Space Rogue at Origin, and had worked on Flight Sims before then. So, you know, I had a 3D sim background, you know, in the game industry very early on. So those influences all sort of came together. And the folks that I brought aboard, you know, was a simpatico is the way these things happen. I mean, you know, I'm interested in certain things, so I'm reaching out to people who have similar interests. Ned Lerner was one of the guys involved for a bunch of years, the early years of Blue Sky and Looking Glass. He had a studio out in California, Lerner Research. He was the guy behind Chuck Yeager, and so he had, you know, that's where I got my sim experience working with Ned on Chuck Yeager. So he had that sim background, and he brought that, you know, very much that mentality to it. So, yes, and there's no question that these earlier influences from the 80s and then going into Blue Sky, which late 92 became Blue Looking Glass, we would have stayed Blue Sky Productions, but we found out that there was a company called Blue Sky Software that had founded a year before us, and so it was we couldn't keep the name, so we changed our name. But it was the same studio. So we had these influences coming in, and again, I think, you know, we were very much into experimenting. We weren't worried about taking the risks. We wanted to take the risks. We wanted to try this out. And I think the folks that joined us, you know, Doug Church being a prime example, fully up for taking those risks, wanted to take those risks, saw this as an opportunity to let's innovate, let's try this stuff out. Is it going to be commercially successful? Who knows? You know, I mean, obviously we were also a business, so, you know, we wanted to be commercially successful. We thought we were, you know, doing, you know, being, you know, reasonably savvy. But while we saw most of our fellow developers sort of doing the what was successful the last 2 years, let's do a better version of that. So a more incremental approach of let's take that and refine it. Let's do better graphics or better technology or improve the renderer. But in terms of genre and gameplay and mechanics, let's stick with a recipe that has proven success, we would almost go the opposite direction and say, no, we're not going to do that because we know. So we avoided doing a shooter. We could have done a shooter. We had some debate at one point of when Ultima, after we were nearly done with Ultima Underworld, it's like, should we just take this engine and do a shooter? I mean, that seems like the more obvious thing to do. And for better or worse, we said, nah, let's not do a shooter. One of the new projects we started out in late 93 was Terra Nova, which a lot of people don't remember. It wasn't a commercial. It was didn't do very well. But I think it was also very innovating in its own way. We learned a lot from that science fiction game that, again, was sort of a cross-genre first person. But it had, we were trying to do some RTS elements in it, where you had a squad. It was very loosely based on the fiction of Starship Troopers. So you were coming down as these, you know, futuristic Marines on alien planets, and calling in, you know, fire support and deploying your squad of troops, and you could communicate with your guys and give them AI commands. But the AIs were very, very sophisticated for the time for that game. It really pushed a lot of boundaries, but it didn't ultimately come together as a great game. We struggled with it. That was, I think, the longest game we ever had in development. It was about 3.5 years. So we became, you know, as a studio, Looking Glass became known because the other title we were working on in that period that got released around the same time, in, I think, 95, was Flight Unlimited. So going back to the flight sim roots, Ned in particular had done a very early pioneering flight sim. I mean, Check Air was EA's most successful title in 85. It did over 500,000 units. I think it was the best-selling PC game of all time at that point. And so it was a great commercial success. And come the mid-90s, the PC sim market was still quite healthy. You had Microsoft with their civilian flight sim, and you had EA with their Jane series of military flight sims. And so we decided to do our own flight sim, and we did Flight Unlimited. And that was a hit for us. That did quite well. That was on par with Ultima Underworld. And we self-published. It's our first title that we self-published. We took a big kind of gamble as a business, raised some venture capital about a year before we launched that title so that we could become a publisher and self-publish the game. We actually did call it an affiliate publisher. So Virgin Interactive did the actual distribution of the title, but we did all the marketing. We manufactured the game. We basically gave finished goods to Virgin for them to distribute.
You did several sequels too, right?
Yep, we did two sequels to that game, and it was a real success out the gate, and that really tapped into our simulation background. I mean, that was a straight up, it was a civilian flight sim. The innovation there, there was a couple of innovations. We went further with the texture mapping in terms of the terrain mapping, so we used satellite imagery of and aerial photography of the ground, so we could map photorealistic terrain, which had never been done in a PC game before, and then the flight dynamics. Seamus Blackley was the guy behind all the flight dynamics, and that was quite innovative. We were able to do aerobatic maneuvers, which had never been done in a sim, even in a commercial, multi-million-dollar sim, using some pretty cool physics.
You mean for like how the wind works and how the lift in the plane works and everything?
Yeah, Seamus, and it's beyond my physics knowledge, he modeled, the fluid dynamics around the plane using some pretty advanced math. He was getting his PhD in physics, in particle physics, when we hired him. And I remember I can't remember his name, but a well-known particle physicist at the time who worked at Fermilab came to our offices and begged us not to hire him. He said, you're hurting physics. We need this guy for physics. So it felt really badly. But Seamus said he was, he didn't want to do traditional physics. He wanted to get into games. So in any event, there was some real innovation on that title, and it was commercially a big success. So it kind of, in a way, it was similar to Ultima Underworld. We took some real risks. We did some real innovation. And we had commercial success with it. And the benefit for us is that, unlike Ultima Underworld, it was completely our title. We were able to do whatever we wanted with it. We self-published it. And so that was an evolution of Looking Glass. We had grown quite a bit by that time in the mid-90s. We were 60, 70 people, something like that. It felt like we'd grown a lot from my perspective. We had a publishing group. You know, we brought in a head of publishing and marketing people and sales people. And so our complexion was changing. And it had its own challenges because, you know, I'm a development guy. I don't really know anything about publishing side, marketing and sales. And I think for a lot of our core development guys, there was some degree of tension between, you know, now we're turning into a, you know, publishing organization and, you know, how does that drive the business and where are the priorities and such. But, you know, at that time, it was a big shot in the arm for a business because suddenly we were seeing, you know, revenues never seen close to that before with Flight Unlimited. But we still had, you know, some of these development projects where we were hybrid, Flight Unlimited was the only title, the first title and the only one we had that was self-published. And we started trying to migrate the business to doing all the titles self-published because the margins are much, much higher and the revenue is much, much higher when you self-publish. And we had some, you know, we ran into some big road bumps. And we released Terra Nova, and that was a flop. And that was that was our most expensive game. We put the most money behind that one. And all of the profits that we earned on Flight Unlimited basically got wiped out by what happened on Terra Nova. So it was a wash in essence. So that was kind of frustrating. We also did a strategic deal with Virgin, with Viacom at the time, but they owned Virgin Interactive, and that ended up being pretty much a boondoggle because Viacom had at that point in time in the 94-95. Was getting into games, decided the games was going to be big for them, and so they were making big investments. They acquired Virgin Interactive. They made an investment in us around doing a Star Trek game. And 2 years later, they were out of the games business. So they sort of got in quickly, and they got out quickly. And so that ended up just being, you know, a huge distraction and a loss to the business there. So we had some distractions such as that, and we also had a broad business issue. We had raised venture capital in 93-94 time period, and the venture guys, they have a window of which they want to see either you're gonna become a rocket ship and go, you know, 5x, 10x, 20x, or you're not. And depending on the venture group, you know, it's 2, 3, 4 years to show one or the other. And so we were at about that 3-4 year mark, and it was clear that we were not, you know, at that point we're not a rocket ship. This was also at the early stages of the .com, big .com. So our venture group groups and as others had some very early .com success, and were seen 100-fold. So the bar was doubly high. It wasn't, you know, the normal historic, you know, 10x being a success. It was, can you be 100x? And it was clear that, you know, that wasn't going to happen with us. So our venture guys basically said, okay, we can see you guys aren't going to go public. You're not going to, you know, be some huge value company. So really we were put on a road to just sell it, let's get out. And that ultimately creates some struggles because when we tried to find someone who would acquire us, and we had to, you know, we had basically no choice, we ended up, we looked at some companies, these were the obvious candidates, didn't want to do anything of interest that would work for the venture guys. And we ended up getting acquired by a local Massachusetts company, Intermetrics. And they were good guys, and they were not a game business. Their main clients were General Motors and NASA. They did mission critical software. So
sounds important.
Well, as the CEO described it, if we have a bug, people die. So, you know, they were extremely good at very robust software that worked and did not have bugs. You know, that was their specialty. And they had been a public company that was then brought back private. They were, you know, a good sized company. They had some, you know, hundreds of employees and you know, tens of millions in revenue. So they were, you know, mid-sized, you know, company. The CEO had come from an entertainment background, and he wanted to grow. He thought that he looked at the game business as a good business to grow an additional revenue stream and to branch out from their core business. So they acquired us as part of that, and then they had an existing group doing Nintendo games, and we were merged with that group. And so now we were doing Nintendo 64 games.
Which games?
Well, the game that you may have heard of is Command and Conquer for the N64.
Oh, okay.
There were a couple other games you never heard of. One was only released in Japan that we got to work with Miyamoto-san on.
Really?
That, which was a lot of fun.
Wow.
But ultimately, the Nintendo side didn't work out. It was it's a real challenge to make third-party Nintendo games. It always has been. And we really weren't equipped to do that effectively. So, you know, we did okay at it, but it ultimately didn't go anywhere. And the other thing with Intermetrics is they ended up getting acquired by Titan Technologies, a DC billion-dollar defense contractor. And pretty much the day after that happened, the board of Titan said, oh, we have no interest in having a game company, dump it. So that ended up, so now we're in 1999. So, you know, the end after 10 years, that was the end of Looking Glass at that point, because our owners, you know, didn't want to have a game company, and they just were impatient, so they said, just sell it off, you know, do it as an asset sale, you know, find somebody who wants to buy the IP, and we just want to get rid of it. So, you know, unfortunately, but we had a lot, you know, when we raised venture capital going back, you know, 93, 94, we already were on track to basically kind of losing control of our destiny, which is what happens often when you do venture capital, for better or worse. I mean, it can work out fine. I, you know, no folks who've raised venture capital, but because we didn't meet the expectations, then, you know, where the company went, you know, couldn't really control at that point.
So it sounds like that's kind of like an overview, right, of the whole situation. And that's interesting, because I know that from the perspective of fans of the company, all they remembered was kind of Thief 1 and Thief 2, and then they were waiting for Thief 2 gold, and then suddenly everybody was like, oh, the company's gone. And everybody was like, what happened?
Right.
And I even have spoken to some people at the company who were talking about that suddenness. And you're saying it was because of this whole defense contractor thing?
Oh, well, yes. I mean, we were in that final year. I'm trying to remember. We were doing $8 or $9 million in revenue. We were break even. You know, we weren't in financial stress. We weren't doing great, but we basically was a break even year. But you know, when you suddenly find a new owner and the owner is a, you know, billion-dollar defense contractor, this is just such a tiny little distraction. In their point, they had no interest in being in the games industry. Probably smartly, they didn't. What did they know about games? We weren't highly profitable. I guess it would have been different had we been making, you know, huge margins and a lot of profit. And it would have also given us the opportunity to do something. But no, for them, it was just the sort of the they didn't see sense in trying to keep this thing going. So they just said, you know, they thought that the most value could be gotten out of an asset sale. So
that's just illuminating for me, because I, in gamer culture, and especially in the incredibly active Looking Glass fan community, they have that website Through the Looking Glass, and endless message boards where they're still talking about Underworld and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
There's all these urban legends as to like what happened to Looking Glass. And
well,
a lot of people, I was
under NDAs and everything at the time.
Okay.
Those have expired, so it doesn't really matter.
Right.
But you know, at the time, I couldn't really get into the details. And at some level, it doesn't really, from my perspective, it doesn't really matter. I mean, we couldn't go forward. So, and we weren't really able to do anything. When we sold off the assets, Eidos picked up Thief and a couple other things. Ultima Underworld is an interesting IP, because I actually personally own the underlying IP to it. But Ultima itself, that brand and anything that's Ultima content specific, EA owns after they acquired Origin. So it's the kind of thing where for an Ultima Underworld to happen, EA and I have to agree to do it. And I've spent years trying to convince EA to do another Ultima. And they've thought about it, and they've talked about it, and, you know, nothing's ever happened.
What if you just made a game called Underworld? It doesn't work like that?
Well, I'm not a lawyer, but if it called Underworld and it kind of looked and felt like Underworld, it'd probably be trademark infringement, because if a consumer could be confused that, oh, is this a sequel? then that gives grounds for a publisher to say you're infringing. I mean, EA has the trademark to Ultima and Underworld. And, you know, I think from EA's perspective over the years, they haven't seen it as a big enough franchise to you know, get behind. And it's an old franchise now. I mean, there's certainly fans of it, but I think anyone under the age of 30, I don't know if they know it, have heard of it.
That sounds kind of direct and just kind of, not simple exactly, but fairly clear. I guess I was expecting it to be more convoluted, perhaps, or the reasons.
Well, that's really what it came down. I mean, there are details in it, but you know, when you're owned by another company, you know, the decisions of what happens with the company, whether it gets sold, whether more investment comes on it, you know, whatever happens, that's our board became the Titan board. Those were the people making the decisions of what happened with the company.
So, you were saying that while you were not, losing money, you weren't making a lot of money either.
No.
With the Thief
and
game,
we had in the previous years, we had up and down years. We had some years we made a little bit of money, lost a little bit of money. We were never very well capitalized. You know, we raised relatively small amount of venture capital, we certainly made some business mistakes. We invested a lot in some of our titles and our technology. We tried to build our own engines, which, you know, a lot of companies had moved to licensing engines by the mid to late 90s, and we were still building all of our own tech. Had some advantages, but it was expensive. You know, we had at peak when we were part of Intermetrics and had the Nintendo development, and we had a studio in Austin, Seattle, LA, Boston, and we had about 130 people all told. Mm-hmm. So we were pretty big size for a studio and had a, you know, big burn rate, a lot of costs. And I think we just stretched ourselves too thin. I mean, particularly between the Nintendo 64 business and still doing the PC side of things, we were starting to do some console work. In terms of genres, we were doing, you know, Nintendo platform games, Command & Conquer and RTS. We were doing sequels of Flight Unlimited, a traditional PC flight sim. Doing Thief. We had golf games. So, you know, I think one of the things, do it all over again, we would have just focused down. I look at studios like Valve, Blizzard. There's a much tighter focus in kind of what they do. And I think that we felt the ability to kind of do anything. I mean, we have had historically some great success. When we did Madden, it was a huge success, and we had never done a football game before. And so I think you get a little bit of hubris and a little bit of sense of, you know, sure, pick us a genre, pick us a platform, we'll do a hit game for you. And our tracker was pretty good in terms of hits, better than 9 out of 10 studios. But we weren't so good at translating that to the success of the business. A lot of our hits were done as development for other publishers, and so our ability to leverage that and get, you know, real profits from that was very limited. And for our own self-published titles, it was kind of became hit and miss. You know, Thief we ended up doing as a development deal with Eidos, and as a result, we didn't see the real big upside on that one. And that was Thief and Thief 2 were our biggest successes in the latter years of Looking Glass. They were quite successful, on par with what the original Ultima had done. And, you know, we were really building a franchise there. Eidos saw more of the economic value out of that than we did, which I think was a big reason why they picked it up as a franchise. We did take a lot of risks and were able to go for 10 years and had some years of great success. So, on balance, it wasn't so bad from a business standpoint. In terms of the games and innovation, yeah, I mean, that was always at our forefront. We were more about the games and the opportunity to innovate. It was almost more like, let's create for ourselves the opportunity to do something that people haven't tried before and see whether it flies or not. And that was sort of a premise that from day one that we went in on it, not scared to take the risks, pushing people to take the risks and to try things out. I've always felt that the game industry could benefit from more innovation, and that the publisher cycle of let's do a rehash, a slight refinement of last year's hit, doesn't move the industry forward. You know, it may be a way to you know, generate revenue if you're a public company, but the industry needs long-term, thrives on innovation like any of these industries do. Someone has to go out of the box and do something. So I felt like that was our job to do that.
But,
so we looked for opportunities to do that.
I feel like a lot of ways, a kind of a nice way of looking at the company in that way is kind of like taking a lot of those hits of being on the forefront of a lot of that innovation. It's like, well, we're just going to
try. A lot of the arrows in the back, yeah. We were fine taking some arrows in the back. It wasn't too many. It was a lot of fun. I mean, and a number of folks who've worked at Looking Glass through the years have said that they've never had that kind of experience before or since, that the culture there was pretty darn unique. It was there's a lot of electricity. And that, to me, that was the most satisfying aspect of just, you know, going in any given day and with the teams and seeing that kind of that electricity and that sense of, you know, we're really innovating here, we're trying things out. I have not been at a game studio that's had that, you know, that level.
This is one of the things that has come up over and over again, mm-hmm. talking to other people. It came up talking to Randy Smith, to Greg LaPiccolo, to Mark LeBlanc, and all these different people. They've all said that, Ken Levine even said this too. He was saying that, you know, you had a real sense that you were put into this room with a bunch of really smart people, and nobody was telling you, okay, you can't do this or you can't do that or you can't do this. Yep. I mean, people had jobs, of course, but the sense that there was a lot of different people from different backgrounds together really kind of almost like jamming on these ideas.
Right.
Seems to, you know, in some cases the experiments, you know, didn't work out as well as in other cases, but then
that's going to happen.
And which is, of course,
you learn
from
it.
You learn from it, right.
Yeah.
But when it did work out, it seemed like it worked phenomenally well, and we got games that we would have never gotten otherwise.
Partly, you know, my background, I got into games very early on as a young kid, but in college, I wasn't a computer science major, I was a geology major, actually, but I took a lot of computer science courses. But what really got interested in computers is that there was an informal group of students and graduate students who were interested in games, and we just got together and started jamming on making games. We made multiplayer real-time games on the time-sharing system, and it was just a blast to me just to find this collection of different people from different backgrounds, you know, smart people, and just start working on games. And so for me, that was sort of a light of saying, oh, this is an interesting way to work. This isn't, you know, you can create stuff with a team. And I think at Origin, a little different, you know, because it was more commercial, but still there was a lot of smart, very creative people, you know, Richard and Chris, and these guys were very passionate and very smart. And they had a somewhat different culture, but there was still a lot of opportunities for people just to get together and jam and brainstorm. And that's what I enjoyed the most. And so, you know, Blue Sky and then Looking Glass, it was an opportunity to create a company that was one of the fundamental tenets. Let's find smart, motivated, passionate people.
I think you can tell when a game is made by predominantly computer scientists.
Right.
And that doesn't mean they're bad games.
Right.
They're great games. But they
tend to be more narrow focus.
There's a different feeling. The games are coming culturally. They're fermented in a different kind of culture.
Yeah.
And the sensibilities that inform them on a subconscious level. It seems like this is the kind of thing you would want to recreate at a company now, right? It's kind of like, how would you... try to support this kind of creative
environment. Well, I think that the culture environment, I mean, we had our issues, but overall the culture environment was quite good. I think a mistake we made in hindsight was being too broad in terms of the genres, as it were, the games, kinds of games we were doing. And so there would be tension between, say, folks working on a golf game and then working on Thief. I mean, it's the very different kinds of games. And it's hard to optimize for both. And certainly, I think most people probably would say at the time, golf was a second fiddle. It just wasn't as exciting. It wasn't as innovative. Not that it couldn't have been, but it didn't get the level of attention. And so, you know, we had some tensions there. But, you know, it was very eclectic. I remember Warren years ago said, for our earlier generation of games, you know, particularly System Shock. His comment is, you know, games developed by MIT guys for MIT students, you know, not entirely fair. We had a good contingent of MIT engineers, but certainly have other folks who didn't come from an engineering or MIT background at all. But we did, one thing in that arc going, you know, we had Ultima Underworld. With System Shock, we got pretty hardcore. And System Shock, in some ways, was our most experimental title, I think, by fair to say, of any we did over the years. We took the most amount of risks. It was sort of a crazy development. One of the things that I've learned is one of the most effective ways to do development is you get a relatively small team. When teams get bigger, you lose productivity. You can get 10, 20 folks in one office space, they all can kind of see each other. That just tends to work the best, particularly when you have this mix of skills. That's how you get people to really mash it up. System Shock was done that way. We had this tight group for a while. Actually, near the end, we had people all crammed in one small space as we were moving into new spaces. But that was a very tight development cycle. We got a ton of stuff done, but it was very innovative. But the downside of that game is it was pretty hardcore. I mean, you had to be the early learning curve is extremely steep for that, particularly for that era. People hadn't seen a lot of this first person kind of user interface and technology. And it was a very demanding game, and so commercially it was not a flop, but it didn't. I think we ended up selling about 120,000 copies or something. Didn't make money for us. Let's put it that way. But it probably was. I would point to that one as the most outweighing in terms of the amount of innovation compared to the commercial success. It was the most extreme on that end.
Was that you had mentioned a while ago that a lot of the ideas that you had, a lot of the moving forward ideas you had during Underworld 1, in Underworld 2 it was kind of this quickie where you didn't get to. So was System Shock kind of the real Underworld 2?
And I think maybe there's a dynamic of it being a little bit of a release valve. Finally, it was a long time because it was almost 3 years in before we started from when we saw the original Ultima Underworld, from when we started System Shock two and a half years in, something like that. So by that time, people were getting a little tired of the Ultimas and the experience of coming off of Ultima Underworld 2. And so we really wanted to do something, felt very different. And it was a chance to innovate. We did a lot of innovations. So it's an amazing game. I mean, there's just so much to it. And you can play it so many different ways. It sort of was a foreshadow of a lot of what Deus Ex, further refined. We really went for it wasn't simply an immersive environment, which we pushed even further, but it was one where we really encouraged the player to figure out how they wanted to solve any particular situation. And so we always tried to set up a particular area of the ship you were pushing through to say, well, we're gonna set up this kind of sim, this immersive environment, and the player may find some solution path that designers never even think about. And we intentionally want to be that the case, that there's no script here. We'll set things in motion and let the player figure out how they get through that. And players love that. They come up with all sorts of hackly solutions to, hack a defense turret and then move it around and take out the enemies with it and all sorts of crazy stuff, which we, a lot of which we never came up with on our own or thought that they'd solve with. It was also, we innovated on story. I think the story was remarkably compelling for what it was, because the experience that we would have, that we started to go down the route with Terra Nova, we didn't want to take on System Shock of doing a cinematic sort of storytelling. So we wanted to do an immersive in-game storytelling, but we didn't have the resources or couldn't figure out how to do that in a more traditional way. So we said, well, we'll sprinkle a story about as little snippets that you pick up on your way. We came up with a fictional take on this, which was sort of funny, that we'll just have everyone killed off. Everyone's dead when you're so there's no one to talk to. But we'll then sprinkle about these little recordings that you can just, find, where people say these little snippets of story, backstory, and you can piece that together as you go through. And that worked remarkably well. And this is a classic example of a risk. We had no clue if this would work, if people would get it. But at least people got into System Shock, loved that. And I think it worked really, really well. But overall, the game was pretty darn hardcore, and particularly early on, and I think that really dampened the commercial success of it. Thief was a reaction to that, of saying, look, we've learned a lot about making immersive games and blending some of these sim elements and gameplay mechanics that work in this first-person kind of environment. we do want to be commercially successful. How do we do this in a way that's more approachable? How do we do the storytelling and the gameplay in a way that, you know, we can reach a larger audience? Because it's not just, you know, innovating is great, but if only three people play it, it doesn't really matter.
I was one of the three.
Yeah. Well, as I said, we ended up selling about 120,000 units, and I'm sure, you know, twice that was shared, or five times that was shared. So it definitely got played. And within the industry, people knew about System Shock, and it's still among the highest rated, you know, games historically. So it certainly helped us from that standpoint of a credibility of doing something completely original. And because it wasn't based on Ultima, you know, with Ultima there was always some industry sense of how much was that was Origin, and how many, you know, Origin did almost zero development work on it. But because it was an Ultima, it was viewed as, you know, kind of a hybrid between what Origin brought to the table. With System Shock was our ability to do something that was totally on our own. So it established kind of our independent studio credibility of we can build something completely original that's very innovative and has real impact. So I think that's a good marker title to look at. But it also was not a commercial, so we lost money on that title. And we didn't want to do that going forward. So Thief, and it took a few years to get around to Thief, but then when we got to Thief, that was our opportunity to really take what we had learned and create something that was commercially more successful. And it had its own innovations with the stealth and the whole stealth mechanic.
There weren't stealth games at the time.
Well, you know, Metal Gear Solid. There were some stealth games, but not in a first-person context. But it was still an innovative title. I mean, again, you couldn't point to anything that was quite like it. So still from a high-level, you know, perspective. And Eidos, at this point, was at the peak with the Tomb Raider series. And so kind of similar to Wing Commander, that was a lot of their everything went through the lens of that's what happens to these publishers often. Whatever's the hot blockbuster at the time, every other game under development, they look at the lens of that. How does it match up compared to that? And there was some skepticism by Eidos that first person really made sense, you know, because the third person, and obviously their console, this was PlayStation primarily where they were making their money. So console, third person with that kind of UI control and sensibility, they knew all about and they were having huge commercial success with. We were coming with a PC first-person game. So for them, they got it. I mean, they were excited about it, and they definitely marketed the title, but it wasn't at the level that they were, you know, looking at some of their console third-person stuff. It ended up being a, you know, big success. But it was another example, I think, where we took a mashup of different people with different backgrounds and skills, and we said, let's take a real risk. You know, who knows if this is going to work?
As a game,
it's kind of crazy.
Yeah, no, well, crazy in a great way. Yeah, one of the things that I do recommend to people, just as a designer, is that what I call the design trilogy, right, of Underworld, mm-hmm. System Shock, Thief, and mm-hmm. how you can see a lot of those ideas revised, right? Yeah. It's kind of like I think that, you know, one of the enduring legacies of the company, I think, is kind of, you know, the idea of a first-person game that's not just a shooter. And, right. and it's not, I don't want to say more cerebral, just because I found them to be very emotionally compelling, right? So there's mm-hmm. they're not distant, right?
Right,
I mean,
right.
But I think that there's something extremely thoughtful and strategic and, mm-hmm. and deep in terms of, like, the narrative that you're engaging in, but mm-hmm. also the emergent gameplay that I'm not getting out of a lot of games that came afterwards, or a lot of other kind of first-person mm-hmm. games at the time. And you were saying earlier that it's kind of a shame to kind of pigeonhole the immersive first-person concept with shooting. And it seems to me that the Looking Glass games are the real historical thing you can point to as being the games that really showed what it can be.
Yeah. Well, we never like to be categorized. We never like to think of our games in the way a publisher would, in terms of a genre. Makes it harder to market things and sell things. So I understand why marketing salespeople do it. They do it for good reason. But from a creative standpoint and in terms of innovating, it didn't really matter what the genre was or the category was. We were trying to innovate on the experience. And you know, years before, I had done a lot of, you know, pen and paper role-playing. And, you know, when you have a really good pen and paper role-playing campaign, you forget about the rules of the game. It doesn't matter whether you're playing Dungeons and Dragons or making up your own rules. And you forget, you're just immersed. It's like any good film or play. There's a, beyond a suspension of disbelief, it's just a full immersion in the experience. You're living that character. You're in that environment. You forget about the world around you. And so I think that was one aspect when you think of immersion, or that was one aspect we were trying to reach for in these games, that experience of, if I'm a thief, what does it feel like to be a thief? You know, if I'm you know, rummaging around some, you know, nobles, you know, apartments and trying to find something, you know, what would I worry about? What would be impacting me? What would I be hearing? What would I be thinking? And how do you translate that into a game experience? And so you're trying to get a transparency and a directness there, you know, that immersion, if you will, that doesn't really care about genre. It doesn't really care about whether it's a first-person shooter. The first-person is just a means to an end of delivering that direct experience. Because if you did it as a text adventure, maybe you wouldn't, you know, delivering that stealth experience, would I describe it, that sort of first time that I saw stealth can work, doing that in a text adventure, probably not going to work so well. So it was just a tool to get you to that place.
So when you talk, I remember you'd said earlier there was that idea of hybrid and role-playing, mm-hmm. right? So it sounds like over the course of the company, role-playing, I'm interested to hear your definition of role-playing, because it seems like a lot of people associate role-playing with stats, but it sounds like Underworld's the game with the stats. And then System Shock, it kind of gets engineered out, and all these other kind of experiential mechanics design, dynamics design, atmosphere all begin to kind of be the center of what that means.
Well, from pen and paper role-playing, you know, the moments when people really get incredibly engaged is when they feel like they're the character and they get excited. I think they forget about stats, you know. And, you know, when we worked with Ultima Underworld, we had to make it at least nominally an Ultima. And so we brought in some of the stats that the Ultimas are traditionally used. But that was never a focus of it. It was more the experience, you know, as your skill builds up on weapons and seeing how they work. You know, we actually modeled, it's very primitive by today's standards, but, you know, the different sword strokes that you could do as you're fighting a beast. We didn't want to show stats up on the window. You know, you could do a D&D thing where you'd show, you know, your percent chance to hit and dodge and, you know, those kinds of things. So already by then we were trying to hide that in the background. There were panels you could flip over and see some of these stats. But we wanted the focus to be in that little window that we could render. And combat was the experience of swinging a sword at an opponent, you know, a skeleton or, you know, orc standing in front of you. It was not the stats per se. But at the same time, as a game, there's narrative, and then there's the character progression, the sense of aspiration and the character development. And certainly for games like Ultima, Ultima Underworld more so than System Shock, more direct way, it's partly about my character becoming more powerful and sort of I'm specializing and becoming, you know, really good at these. You know, you could learn the different spells that you could cast, and when we use the rune system. And that's been historically an important aspect of those, you know, traditional role-playing games. We did carry that forward, but we wanted to express it. You know, when you cast a spell, you see the spell casting out, you know, into the world. And, you know, you cast it in, you know, by arranging the runes to make the spell. We wanted to be a very tangible way, you know, rather than it's some abstract system. You know, you're playing a D&D game where you're, you know, style game where you've got, you know, magic stats that you're playing with. No, you're a real wizard and you're, you know, composing runes. And so, again, it was trying to take you through into this fiction as if you were really there. And you have a character. That character is going through a narrative arc, a story that's creating a context for your reason why you're doing these quests, meaning why you're doing these quests, and an opportunity platform, aspirational platform to develop your character. So those are all elements of role-playing. I think with System Shock, we carried a lot of that forward. One of the things we did is that System Shock went much deeper in terms of the systems that you could, you know, all the different mods that you could do for your character, both in terms of the depth and flexibility. We really went to town. I mean, that was one of the learning curve hurdles, is all the different ways you could develop your character and use those skills and mods and different combinations. It was, you know, fivefold more than Ultima ever did. Again, we tried to do it in a fictional context. It wasn't kind of a spreadsheet. You know, it was all done in the fiction of the game as much as we could do that. character development was a little different there. It wasn't becoming a powerful character because, you know, the game takes place in a relatively short span. It's a science fiction game. You know, you're not developing a D&D style character, but you were learning these skills and these kind of mods and you know, biomechanically improving yourself, so to speak. By the time we got to Thief, we wanted to simplify it and make it more accessible. So one of the decisions, for instance, was just give the player a few tools to work with. You know, they have their bow, they have their sword. You know, you've got your different attachments for your, you know, the water arrow or the, you know, the different kinds of arrows you can use. It's a pretty small palette compared to System Shock, System Shock 2. And so we really narrowed it down, and we focused more on give the player a lot of different ways and subtle ways and not so subtle ways they can use this small toolkit. So there's a lot of flexibility to that. And I think that certainly in terms of accessibility, that worked much, much better. And the UI, we also changed, like the light gem, you know, things that were much kind of more tangible, you know, similar to the runes, but in a more, even more direct and tangible and simplified, as it were, way. So the light gem, you know, was a great way to see whether you were in the shadow or not in shadow, rather than some stat or
telling you how sneaky you are, right,
yeah,
or something.
Yeah.
Actually, what I wanted to do was ask you a bit how, if I don't know if it's like NDA stuff, if it is, that's fine. But like, how you see kind of your post Looking Glass stuff, and like how. Mm-hmm. How all of this learning, how some of these philosophies of design and production filter, if in any way, to sort of what you've done since and how you're, what you're doing now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the things that I enjoyed most, as I was saying earlier, was just that the environment, the culture that we were able to build and sustain over the decade, and just some wonderful people, some real talent, folks who've, you know, so a number we brought new into the game industry and have gone on to continue to do some great stuff. So that's pretty cool. And that's, to me, that's even better than the games that we built. It's just the culture and then the people that came out of that and what was learned from that process. It's not the product itself that at the end of the day matters to me the most, but sure, a lot of fun building those games. So, you know, following Looking Glass, it was pretty traumatic for me. I shut down. So it took a little bit of time off. But it started up a new studio, Floodgate, which ran for 10 years.
When did you start Floodgate?
In 2000.
2000, okay.
So it took about half a year off and then started up Floodgate. And decided to take a change of pace. I had been doing, you know, basically mostly PC, these kinds of games, you know, high-end games for 15 years. So I wanted to try something different, so I really looked at the mobile space as a new emerging space at that time, and just try something totally different.
What is this again? 2000?
2000.
2000. So that's really early in the mobile games.
Yeah, this is very early mobile. This is a Brew J2ME stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And we spent the first year or two kind of doing a mishmash of stuff. It was not an easy time to start a business because this was when we really got, because it was not long after 9/11 where we really got the business starting to going, and so trying to raise money and all and was not easy. So we did a lot of our financing just through getting project deals, and we worked on the first expansion of Neverwinter Nights. The Shadows of Undertide was an early project that we
really
did.
Wow.
So that just, you know, with a role playing background, and brought some, you know, folks aboard who worked at Looking Glass, and that was actually quite successful. That was a blockbuster, well exceeded everyone's
Shadows of Undertide specifically.
Yes,
was?
Specifically, was a huge seller. It outsold, you know, publishers' expectations by, you know, like fivefold. So, and the BioWare guys, it was great to work with them. Some really talented folks, and there was some similarity there in that they. Huge amount of passion by the BioWare guys, and you know, they really, you know, in terms of the role playing, they had been doing innovating and continue to do in their own field. So that was a good opportunity there. We did some work with on Arc Fractalis.
I didn't know about this.
It was we had a side role, small, you know, relatively side role, but Raphael there, he was a huge fan of Ultima Underworld, one of his favorite games, and so he reached out and said, you know, would you guys want to help out? So we did, and we did a little bit of design work and some artwork on it.
And the company was, it was, what is the company that did Arx Fatalis? I'm blanking on them, right?
I'm blanking on, I'll think of it in a minute. They got acquired a year or two ago by Bethesda.
Arcane,
thank you. Arcane, and they had worked. Raphael was big friends with Richard Garriott too, so we had that connection as well. And they very much said, you know, we want to create Arx Fatalis as a. I'm sorry, it wasn't Arx. I misspoke. Well, it was the sequel to Arx Fatalis we worked on. Arx Fatalis had come out, and then they wanted to do. So we're working on Arx Fatalis 2. That's the project, and it got changed to Might and Magic, Dark Messiah. So I played a little bit of Arx Fatalis, and we started discussions with them while Arx Fatalis was under development. But then, when they started to work on the sequels, that's when we got involved. I was off on the title.
I didn't know that. Is this wait? Might and Magic, Dark Messiah is Arx Fatalis too? From a design perspective,
similar to Ultima Underworld, they started as an independent project. They spent a year trying to find a publisher for it. And nobody wanted to, people saw it as an Ultima Underworld, and again, there was some skepticism that that style game could be a big commercial success. They were doing it as a console game. That's really Xbox was their target, and that's even harder to get for publishers to get their heads around. And Ubisoft said, well, we've got this brand that we picked up, the Might and Magic brand, how about we apply Might and Magic to it, and then we'll get behind it. And it ended up doing pretty well. It worked.
I didn't know that. So now I want to play it. I feel like...
Yeah. And so those guys, the Arcane guys, were huge fans of Ultima Underworld, and they wanted to do that, and then later Deus Ex, and so they wanted to do that kind of a gameplay. It's very challenging to do those kinds of games, and I think it's doubly challenging. You've got a publisher who's kind of looking at it from a, we want to put a brand behind this, and because we had gone through that with Ultima Underworld. So Might and Magic Dark Messiah has not had the sort of impact that some of those other titles have had. But it's definitely worth, definitely worth checking out. It's just some pretty cool stuff.
Yeah, because you can play Arx Fatalis and feel the Underworld sort of legacy in there, just in terms of how it's designed and the kind of you're in a cave, deal with it kind of feeling to the whole game. But does Might and Magic Dark Messiah? I suppose I should just play it and find it myself.
It is sort of the next step forward in that.
Oh wow, okay.
So we did some work on those games, but then we moved into mobile and started doing very early mobile work, which was very retro. It was interesting because we were working with phones as low as J2ME phones that might have 100K of heap space to work with, and made the Apple II seem fast and powerful.
I worked at a company that was doing that development in 2003 to 2006 or 2004 to 2007 probably, and I remember there was one phone where the memory on the phone could not support the dimensions of the screen.
Right. Right. It's kind of crazy, and it's all. But it was a design challenge, and I liked it. It was very different. It was trying to make gameplay out of the most primitive tools, and I'm a game designer at heart, and so that was a fun challenge to figure out how to do that. And we had some really good success. I mean, we had some titles that did millions of units, huge success. So commercially, we were having some great success. We're learning a lot about a completely different kind of platform, and all of the sort of the immersive stuff that developed over the years did not apply to these games, put it that way. But that was fun. I wanted to do something different. We did do an Ultima Underworld. We took Ultima Underworld and put it on a pocket PC.
So oh,
that,
really?
That was one thing we did.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah,
I didn't know about that.
No, it didn't get really good marketed.
did you change it much, or was it more like a port, or was it really like much?
It was just a port. The publisher didn't want to do anything more than a port. Actually, got Doug to do a little bit of technical work on it.
Wow, really?
But it was just a fun little side project. It was part of my long-standing, come on, EA, let's do another Ultima Underworld. Anyway, so we did that, and then we started to migrate as the platform, mobile platforms became more capable. We started to get higher end, and towards the end of Floodgate, started to do a lot of smartphone stuff, iPhone, iOS, gaming and development. But again, it was all contract stuff, or nearly all. We did one with Disney. We did Pirates of the Caribbean for cell phones as a massively multiplayer game, which was pretty darn innovative. It was pretty much the first and maybe only massively multiplayer MMO for Brew and J2B cell phones. And, we had tens of thousands of people all playing online with each other across Brew and J2B phones, which had never been done before or since, as far as I know. So it was, we were doing some pretty innovative stuff, but it was in a space that doesn't get this sort of fan attention. Our ultimate audience are people who have a cell phone in their pocket, particularly before the iPhone era, and often the developer didn't get credit or didn't get, whatever, so we were behind the scenes on that.
They're
stuff.
Kind of like, the sense you get, at least when I was working in the company I worked at, is that they're games for people who want to be distracted.
Yes. I've got 5 minutes free, I want to play a little bit of a game. So it was 180 degrees from what we've been doing at Looking Glass, and in a way that was great, and we got very good at it. It had some huge success. But ultimately, we weren't able to really do some original stuff we wanted to do. It's really hard to do original IP in the mobile space. iOS is a little different, but traditionally, J2Me and Brew.
Especially at that time with those.
Even now, you go to a Verizon or AT&T and say, I want to pitch you an original game, and you're a little developer, they won't even talk to you. So it's all about branding, and we did three Madden footballs on mobile. We did...
Came back to Madden.
Came back to Madden. Well, here's a small side story. When we did one of the... In 2005, we did a mobile version of Madden, and EA sent it. They said, we'll send you some code you can work from. In the code, we saw some of the exact code that we'd used from the 92 version that we had done from the Sega Genesis. I mean, it would port it over, but it was the exact same code. Particularly, the core AI code was the same code that carried forward for more than a decade. It was weird seeing that code. But... So, yeah, we worked on basically big branded stuff, and for the most part. It was really hard to do original stuff, and ultimately that was not so satisfying for me. I wanted to do, at least original IP. I didn't have a problem working on these small platforms. With iOS coming in, you could actually do, with the iPad and higher-end iPhones, you can do some...
You had a balance of that at Looking Glass, it sounds like, right? Like, you were doing the kind of, IP stuff to kind of keep things afloat, but that also subsidized the kind of... creative
exactly.
experimental work you wanted to do.
Exactly. At Floodgate, we found very few opportunities to actually do original stuff. It was almost all licensed IP things, and just for a variety of reasons, that was less interesting to do. And it's harder to innovate on that stuff because the publisher generally is a sequel, and they have the constraints on what they allow you to innovate on is much more limited. So we started to get in the very early stages doing social stuff, and it was clear that we'd need a lot more resources than we had as a, because we were a small studio, to really do social. So became part of Zynga, and they have a lot more resources to do social.
And that's what you're, so when did that happen?
In March of this year.
Okay, so it's very recent that you guys.
Yeah, been there 6 months.
When you say became part of Zynga, did Floodgate just get kind of ported over to Zynga?
Essentially. I mean, it was not an outright acquisition, but the team all moved over to Zynga, and we for all intents and purposes, all the talent moved over, and we started working right away. We did Adventure World is the first game. I'm creative director of the Boston studio, and so they had an ongoing game they've been under development since last year, Adventure World, and came on to help on the creative direction of that title.
So it sounds like I know that the work that you sort of got into the industry doing, it sounds like, are you still really interested in the kind of hybrid simulation role-playing kind
Absolutely.
Of thing?
So I still play the games, and when BioShock came out, or games like that, you know, definitely see where it, you know, the industry's going. And it may not be fair. My high level take, I wish there would be faster progress and more innovation in terms of real gameplay and meaningful innovation. Where I see the innovation is on refinement. You know, visuals look more, you know, better than they did last year, a little more polish around the UI or the experience. I've seen relatively little of the kind of innovation that, and it wasn't just Looking Glass, some other studios did. I mean, Valve with the original Half-Life did some amazing stuff. But at large, I think the innovation has become more incremental and slowed down, and I don't see the kind of fundamental pushing forward. And that's partly why I got into the mobile space, because I felt like, well, maybe mobile is a chance to do more innovation because the stakes aren't so high. I mean, I think that's one factor. When you're looking at a, you know, $10 to $50 million budget, you know, these days for a frontline, you know, game on PlayStation or Xbox or whatever, the stakes are so high that it's hard. Publishers, really hard for them to take risks. You know, when Origin, what they put in for Elden Ring was peanuts. So, you know, it didn't really matter to them whether, you know, it didn't, I mean, matter, but it is completely different. And so, you know, when some executive is writing a $25 million check, in essence, to do a game, I don't see them getting behind what would have been System Shock or Thief today. I mean, once in a blue moon, maybe. It's hard enough getting those games, finding publishing partners in the 90s. Today, it's gotten really hard. And, you know, it was a long haul for Irrational to get to BioShock.
They were around for a long time before they did BioShock.
And they struggled. You know, it was tough. So they had some, you know, real tough times there. And, you know, full credit to, you know, Take-Two for getting behind that title and deciding that they were going to really support it. That happens very, very rarely these days.
That's that game almost became a blockbuster before it was out, because the buzz around BioShock 1, there was a lot of marketing push.
Yeah, and in that traditional market, that's pretty much what you have to do. You know, it's all about the first, you know, month of sales, and so pre-sales are a big part of that. So if you haven't gotten a certain amount of pre-sales for a console game, you're pretty much out of the running. Of the rare exception, you're not going to be a hit. And so that pushes it back to, from the publisher's standpoint, of they've got to get the hype at the key trade shows and with, you know, all the media, and they're trying to build all that pre-hype with the media and getting credibility and getting buzz to a level where the retailers will all say, I'll pre-order 500,000 of those or 1 million of those. If you don't have that, you're going to almost always not have a success. So that's become that business model. In that business model, it's harder than it ever was to do something that's truly innovative. So going to a retailer and saying, you've never seen a game like this before, it's kind of strange.
Well, the funny thing too is that if people who are innovation minded and get their own personal sense of creative satisfaction at being a professional practitioner doing that kind of work, but also having it be sustainable. I mean, obviously you look for frontiers, right? I mean, PC in the 90s was still,
yes,
you know, a frontier. And so it sounds like the idea is like, okay, now social is the frontier, or now mobile is the frontier, or you know, Facebook or whatever it is. And I'm wondering, what is your sense of how does that front, for somebody who's made the leap to another frontier in terms of the kinds of, I don't know if immersive is the right word, but those kind of experiential things, is that, how is the current frontier looking for that?
Yeah, so I see social as being very much a frontier space. It's arguably only a three-year-old market, at least in the U.S., if you discount Asia, you know, Korea and such, for the freemium style games. So it's still very new, and there's still a lot of more unknowns than knowns. And I think there's more willingness and a need from folks to try to take some risks and try to say, well, what else can work? You know, we know a Farmville, or, you know, pick a successful social tile. We know that works. We could do three more of those, but what else? You know, this is still very much at the early stages, and the market's going to grow. It's going to evolve. So it's an exciting, from that standpoint, because you can see their opportunities to truly be innovative. So that's really what drew me to the social market, that challenge and an opportunity, and with the whole infrastructure from the consumer, you know, publisher and developer all looking for what's coming next, where is this market going? I mean, it's ultimately driven by the people who play the games, right? I mean, that's ultimately where it happens. I mean, ultimately, the people who play the games will sort of dictate where the industry moves to. They have to be receptive to something. You know, if some team innovates but no one plays it, it doesn't matter from a commercial and industry standpoint. And so you have to find a way to connect with your audience. From a developer standpoint, if you're innovating, you don't go to your customer and say, what do you want more of? You're not going to get the answer. So you're looking ahead, but you're looking ahead to where you think that audience wants to go and where those innovations will actually translate to something that people want to play. And where they say, well, I haven't seen that before. That's cool. Oh, it stands out in a meaningful way to them. And you know, that's the whole trick in trying to look ahead. And you don't want to look. I might argue that system shock, for example, we looked a couple of years too far ahead. You know, so from a commercial standpoint, you've got to look in the mid future. You know, mid horizon. You can't look too far ahead. I think that the social, and using that term very broadly, it's not just about Facebook, you know, games, social games, and the kind of gameplay, from a gameplay genre, how the audience, you know, their experience with it, there's a whole bunch of areas where it's still very early on, and there's a lot of opportunities for innovation. So it's an exciting place to be, and it's growing much faster than, you know, the PC industry did in its early years, or console industry did it. So, you know, and it's reaching a much broader audience, which is cool. I mean, I've never been, you know, some people kind of look at Looking Glass and maybe say, well, it's kind of a niche studio. You know, we did titles first, you know. Not really true. We did some million unit sellers, which in the, you know, 90s was very big. It didn't really get bigger than that. And our intent was never to be niche. We wanted to reach. If we're not impacting a lot of people, it doesn't matter. So we want to innovate. You know, we've always wanted to innovate and create these experiences and then share them with lots of folks. And I think, you know, the social games, the opportunities to share with more people than we've ever had an opportunity before. You know, there's 250 million plus people who regularly play these social games. Gigantic.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's crazy.
It's crazy.
And the funny thing about this is that I think this seems like a pretty good place to stop, but I have one more question, which is that there has been a lot of anxiety, it seems like, in what you might consider the traditional games industry, like the mm-hmm. I suppose like the commercial AAA people, and even from gamers of, you know, these kind of new, more casual games that are reaching these bigger, mm-hmm. or supposedly casual, whatever that actually means, that it's kind of, you know, ruining video games or ruining game design. And one of the things I've heard about, because they're all, you know, simplistic, they aren't, you know, immersive or complicated in the ways that kind of make games feel rich traditionally. But one of the things that I've heard is that from people who have actually sat down with, you know, so-called casual gamers and mm-hmm. studied them and spoken with them and looked at the actual data, looked at the actual play styles, is that it's not that people want shallow experiences, but mm-hmm. a lot of the, it's kind of like what you're saying about System Shock. There's a really deep experience there, but the barrier may be in interface. The barrier may be in learning curve. And there's actually a lot of people who will play, you know, so-called casual games in a hardcore way, right? They may be somebody who's, they're part of the baby boomer generation, but they play, you know, 7 hours of Bejeweled or something, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. right? And that's hardcore gamer behavior. And
I remember on mobile side, we learned this early on, because that was really our first person with truly casual games. Someone playing Bejeweled on their cell phone, who would play it when they took a shower in the morning by putting a plastic baggie over it because they had to keep on playing it. That's hardcore. I don't think anyone played System Shock in the shower. So, yes, these there's plenty of casual players, probably more total players, who play hours a day of these so-called casual games than any given hardcore game. And they really get into it, and it's important to their, you know, it's one of their things they do during the day and they look forward to is, and they may play it in, now that, you know, play style is different. They probably don't play it for 3 hours straight in the evening. They may play it 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 5 minutes, you know, little bursts, but it's still very important to them. And they get really engaged with the experience. And they, yeah, some of these so-called casual games, some of the mechanics, pretty darn complicated for a casual game. Some of the underlying economies of these games and the UIs, you know, just pages of menus you have to go through to, you know, plant, plow, harvest, do buildables, all this stuff is not what you would think of as hard, as casual from an outside perspective. So these, and it's also a question if this is a very new industry. So if you go back 2 years ago, I think a lot of these games were much more truly casual. And you got a lot of gamers who this was their first kind of direct experience intensively playing these games. And so they were learning the ropes. Now those same gamers have a year or two, three under their belt. They're basically hardcore now. They've played 5 or 20 of these games. They've spent hundreds of hours playing these games. They're like any other hardcore gamer. The genre is different. You know, the play style is different. But you see the behaviors are very similar to a hardcore System Shock fan.
Well, what's interesting about this to me is this is what I really think about when I think about, you know, you can see the markets shifting, and you can see, in some ways, it seems like as people who are interested in these more complicated experiences, it's not that we can't still make them or still have them. It's just that now we have to make them for people.
Yeah.
Right? And we have to really think about what that means.
Right. Right.
And it's not that those people don't want those things or are opposed to those things. But, it, you know, 2 years ago for the casual market was, you know, maybe 1981 for the rest of us.
Yes.
Right? And they're just getting up to speed. And it's a literacy, and the culture in general gains it. So, you know, when they get finished with their simplistic game, they're going to ask, what else do you have?
Right.
Things are going to keep going. So, you know, I don't see it as dystopian as I guess the way some
I would agree. And I don't, I mean, I think anything that gets people to play these games, from my perspective, is a good thing. And having a larger, much larger audience, and be able to connect those people. I mean, I think that's the real thing distinctive about these social games. Is and it's still very early on, but they hold that promise to have, you know, really meaningful social, you know, gameplay between friends. And that's where games started before computers were. I mean, you play chess or you play a board game, it's with friends or family. And it's almost been an aberration, you know, from kind of, you know, 80s, you know, the personal computers of somebody, you know, working at, you know, playing by themselves out of their house, which has been a dominant play style of a lot of these games. That's not how games have historically been played if you go back over the, you know, centuries or millennia. And so I think that social games hit more fundamentally how, why people play games and what they get out of games. So I think there's a lot of potential. And I also think the lessons in social games translate to other platforms. I think someone who's doing a PlayStation game today would be smart to play some of these social games, because I think there's things you can learn from it. It's not so narrow as, oh, it's just a Facebook game, and you do that, you know, that's that kind of game, and it hurts that kind of game. I think there's cross-pollination all around.
Well, not every game has to be the same. We can still have genres. We can still have different audiences.
Yes,
you know.
But if I'm doing a you know, a shooter on PlayStation, I think I could learn, and Sony could learn from, you know, what's happening in the social market and start leveraging some of that. Still a shooter, but just a social shooter.
That's the social shooter.
Yeah. That'd be interesting.